The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Parul Sehgal, sitting in today for David Remnick. Later in the show, I'll be talking to the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, a book about nature and our place in it, a book that over 10 years went from word-of-mouth cult favorite to the bestseller lists. But we're starting the show today with a different kind of story about the environment. My colleague, Dhruv Kohler, writes for The New Yorker about medicine and public health, and he's also a physician practicing at a hospital here in New York. Dhruv has been reporting on heat, what it does to us, and what it's going to keep doing as temperature records keep breaking.
Nine. Got it.
All right, we're going to go up in 20 seconds.
There are people in the world who set up labs to test how the human body reacts to all sorts of things. They can analyze your endocrine system when you produce the lactates that'll slow you down.
Nice work.
And there are people who agree to get their bodies tested, like me.
Let's go, Dhruv. Let's go. Looking strong, Dhruv.
I'm Dhruv Kohler. I write for The New Yorker, and I'm a doctor. A few weeks ago, I went to a lab at the University of Connecticut to find out my body's VO2 max, the maximum amount of oxygen my body can absorb and use during exercise.
Yeah, so we're watching two lines on the graph. And right now, they're starting to plateau.
I'm on a treadmill hooked up to all sorts of sensors, and I'm running hard. Every few minutes, they increase the speed until I hit my absolute max.
He's hitting his max.
The UConn lab is particularly interested in three populations: athletes, soldiers, and laborers, like construction workers. As a result, they're increasingly interested in how the body reacts to extreme heat.
I'm going to be walking basically on this treadmill for the next 2 hours in 104 degree heat with 40% humidity. They're going to be tracking all sorts of different metrics.
UConn's heat lab is an environmental chamber that can take you from anywhere near freezing to 120 degrees. The longer you stay in there, the worse it gets.
You know, it feels basically like I'm in a sauna at this point. I just feel extremely puffy everywhere. You'd have to cut my finger off to get my wedding ring off right now.
And then it got even worse.
I have a headache, and I can't even imagine lifting boxes, working outside for hours in this type of weather, although, you know, a lot of people...
The UConn lab is working to understand how these conditions impact people who have no choice about spending hours in extreme heat. The U.S. military in basic training, or farm workers at harvest time. I headed to another room to clean up. My producer inched towards the lab technicians. They were all huddled around screens flashing my biometric data.
What was his starting, Sean?
71.24.
So he lost a little bit more than a kilo. So a little bit more than 2.2 pounds in that 90 minutes of walking.
Of water.
Yeah, of sweat. Isn't that crazy? It's a lot. That's probably why he's not feeling so good.
I was surprised at how long it took for me to get clear-headed and feel hydrated.
We just made sweat soup. So we took him, placed him in here, we took 2 gallons of distilled water, and we went through every body part. So we started with his hair, his face, back of the neck, his armpits, and we had him wipe everything as we were pouring the water over him. And the idea is we wanted to get all of the electrolytes, the sodium, magnesium, the chloride, everything off of his skin and into the water so we can go ahead and put that into our analyzer and we can get an idea of how much sodium, chloride, potassium he sweat out during that hour and a half.
Wow, like reverse Gatorade.
Reverse Gatorade. Yeah, but then the cool thing is he knows that add value.
When I sat down with the head of the lab, we got deep into the mechanics of how heat acts on the body.
I'm Douglas Cassa. I'm the CEO of the Corey Stringer Institute and a professor in the Department of Kinesiology here at the University of Connecticut.
Heat is on a lot of people's minds for obvious reasons. These past few years have been the hottest on the record. We just lived through the hottest month in history, but you've actually been thinking and talking about heat for many decades now. So maybe you could just tell us how and why you first got interested in it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been almost exactly 38 years ago. I suffered an exertional heat stroke as a 16-year-old high school athlete. I was running the 10K race, which is 25 laps on the track, and the Empire State Games, which is a Summer Olympic-style sports festival in upstate New York. I was representing the Long Island division on the very final lap of that 25 laps with 200 meters to go. I collapsed. I got back up immediately, ran 200 more meters, collapsed again 50 meters before the finish line, and then I was unconscious for the next few hours. Wow. I had suffered an exertional heat stroke, and without the amazing care of the athletic trainer on site and the EMS, EMT providers and the emergency room physician and nurses, I would have died, but I was very fortunate to have amazing care.
Did you immediately start thinking that you wanted to make heat and heat stroke and heat-related illness part of your career?
It's really interesting. That night, I talked to the doctor and I talked to the other people who were providing care for me and started to understand how serious it was that really happened to me. And yes, I had actually very soon after, I'd always had an interest in medicine up to that point in time. I was thinking like maybe medical school or something. When I was pursuing college, I was heading into my senior year of high school. But after that, I knew 100% I was going to pursue like sports medicine and research and try to figure out how the body responds to exercise and the heat.
Yeah. And so what is happening in the body when people suffer? I guess heat stroke is kind of the extreme version of this, but there's also a whole spectrum of illness, heat-related illness, heat exhaustion, heat syncope. You know, why do people feel this way when they're exposed to extreme heat or significant heat for prolonged periods of time?
Yeah, I think the best way to explain it is that when you do intense exercise in the heat, whether it be like a soldier, laborer, or an athlete, you have the blood or the fluid in your body has to now be shared by three main entities. So your skin, so you can keep yourself cool, your heart, so you can maintain your stroke volume and your blood pressure, but also your muscles, so you can maintain that level of exercise and performance that you want. When you don't have the heat, that denominator is two items. You know, you just have the muscle and the heart because you're not sending much blood flow out to the skin because cooling is not a key factor. So now the heat brings this massive new part of the equation into it. You have a finite pool of blood, which is the numerator, and the denominator is now dividing by three instead of two. Now that becomes even more exacerbated when you get dehydrated, because now that finite pool in the numerator is now a smaller number that's being divided by three entities. So it's just ultimately this incredible physiological challenge that when you do intense exercise in the heat, when you're dehydrated, you can't meet the demands of those three entities. It's simply impossible. Yeah. So something gives, right? What's going to give? The performance will definitely give. You will heat up because you can't cool down as effectively as you want. And then our cardiovascular ability will falter.
Is that why people who are, you know, older or younger, young children, these people suffer heat-related illness?
Yeah, so I think it's important for people to understand there's two different kinds of heat stroke. So there's classic heat stroke and there's exertional heat stroke. Exertional heat stroke is related to what we've discussed so far. It's you're doing some kind of physical exertion and you're driving your body temperature up. I always say that exertional heat stroke is an overwhelming of the thermoregulatory system. You're simply generating more heat in a given period of time than you're able to dissipate or lose. Classic heat stroke is different. Classic heat stroke, I say, is a failure of the thermoregulatory system, and we see it happen to, for instance, infants left in parked cars during hot weather where they just can't thermoregulate anymore, or old people who have comorbidities like heart, lung, other medical problems who are in like the higher stories of apartment buildings and they don't have air conditioning, and during heat waves the heat gets so oppressive and they don't have the physiological ability to deal with that heat. So those, we have to separate those two things out because there's different populations and there's different strategies you would use to try to prevent that condition from occurring.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of an area of medicine where your intuition about what to do matches exactly what you're supposed to, it sounds like, right? If someone's too hot, throw them in cold water and bring the temperature down as fast as possible. There's not some fancy thing that you should be doing here.
So it's interesting that you say that. It is that simple, but it seems to be so complicated to get people to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So a couple of the hurdles have been, for instance, the concept of cool first, transport second. You always want to cool a person on site and then transport them, because you don't want to wait for an ambulance to come, have ambulance on site, go back to the hospital, and then wait for the hospital to do cooling. That could be 45 minutes to an hour. Yeah. You have 30 minutes to get the patient's temperature to under 104 if you want to assure survivability with an exertional heat stroke. So the common start temp for heat strokes around 108, but it can be anywhere from 105 to 113 is what we've seen and I've seen in my career. So we have to get their temp down as fast as humanly possible, and cold water immersion has the best cooling rates. So if you have a high school football practice, or you have a finish line of a major medical tent, or you have military bases where people are training, people have cold water immersion tubs set up so that we cool them on site. So that concept of cool first, transport second. We also have had to overcome hurdles with people doing rectal temperature on site. So for instance, at some high school settings, we have had non-medical people like superintendents of school districts, athletic directors, principals, balk at delivering best care for their student athletes because they didn't want a rectal temperature done. Mm-hmm. But you have to do a body temperature to, one, assess the condition, but two, to have the objective data to implement cool first, transport second, because the ambulance will arrive and you want to relinquish care when appropriate, but you don't want to have a subjective response. You don't want to say, oh, they're looking better, but their temp might still be 108 degrees.
Yeah.
You want to have it done objectively.
So the rectal temperature is much more reliable than oral temperature, thermometer in the armpit, all these other types of temperatures that we're more used to.
Yeah, so we've done a lot of research that show during intense exercise in the heat, oral AURAL or oral ORAL, tympanic, axillary, skin can be grossly inaccurate when people are doing intense exercise in the heat, as much as 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 degrees away. But there's no like specific consistent relationship that you can do some kind of correction factor. So the most feasible field expedient method to get an accurate core body is a rectal temperature, and it can be done within 10 seconds.
How much of a difference does the humidity make when you're thinking about the danger posed by heat?
Yeah, I would say humidity is huge, and I think it's especially important for people who have to exercise in the heat, because the main way that a person exercising would cool themselves is through evaporation, and that's when that sweat droplet can evaporate into the air. And for evaporation to occur, you need a water vapor pressure gradient, meaning it has to be, you know, more dry outside from where your sweat droplet is. And it's only when the sweat droplet evaporates that we actually cool. So that's why almost all the heat stroke deaths that have happened for athletes in America, laborers, and warfighters happens in the southeastern America. Our recent data showed that the hottest state in America is actually Louisiana, but very close behind is Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. Mm-hmm. So those states are super oppressive. But classic heat stroke can really affect people anywhere because the heat waves, it's happening in apartments that are so oppressive that there's no ability to climate control. And once it gets hot, it gets so stifling. And these people, already are dealing with some other medical conditions, so their thermoregulation is really limited.
You can tell us, you know, obviously people have been talking about climate change for some time, but probably in the last decade or so, it's really became part of our political and national discourse. What was it like, you know, in the late 80s or 90s, early 2000s, talking about heat-related illness when it wasn't on everyone's mind in the way it is now?
I'd say it was a little different. I mean, it was relevant within the populations that still had heat issues. So if you were dealing with laborers and warfighters, soldiers in training or athletes, these are three populations that heat stroke has always been one of the three leading causes of death. Mm. It's just the climate change has taken this into kind of the everyday world for the everyday, like, American citizen. You don't have to be a laborer working for 12 hours. You don't have to be a soldier in training, trying to get through basic training, or a football player during August practices. Now this is making it affect so many people, even just during daily living, daily workouts, daily things that they're trying to do, but now they have to face the extreme heat.
I saw a study recently that they basically modeled what would happen to Phoenix if there was a heat wave and also a power outage. And the number of people, I think it was nearly half the city, might require some level of medical care in that type of setting. So, you know, having air conditioning really is a lifesaver. But in a lot of places like the Pacific Northwest, parts of Europe, they don't have a lot of air conditioning. And so I think that's when you often see these kind of nearly mass casualty events in those settings.
Let's just look at France in 2003. They had 12,000 deaths in 1 week in one country. I just saw data that this past year in 2022, Europe had 61,000 heat stroke deaths, which is just a crazy number for you know, a place that most people would think that have some of the basic resources to protect people. But you just mentioned in Phoenix, it would, heat stroke deaths would be in the many thousands if they just had a few days in a row of a power outage.
Yeah.
Because of all the people who would not be able to cope with that extreme heat.
Yeah.
Every person who's having to live through climate change, they're going to have to make additional efforts to protect themselves, whether it's when they're going out for a walk, a hike, working in their garden, mowing their lawn, doing a job that might have some heat exposure. And the four biggest things you can do to protect yourself is having cold fluids nearby that you drink whenever you want. You don't need a specific break to drink. You're drinking when you need fluids. Second is having cooling strategies in place. So cold, wet towels and a cooler nearby that you can replenish those cold, wet towels, or even having shade, anything that would be a cooling strategy that your microenvironment would be cooler. Third would be implementing work to rest ratios based on the environmental conditions. So if it's hotter out, more brutal, you have more rest breaks that are longer. And fourth is heat acclimatization, using that first week or two of heat exposure to phase in the intensity and duration of activity so that your body can develop those the better physiological responses.
At one point last week, heat alerts from the National Weather Service covered nearly 150 million people in America. Douglas Casa is CEO of the Corey Stringer Institute at the University of Connecticut. He was speaking with Dhruv Kolar of The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. My name is Baril Sagal. We'll be back in a moment.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Baril Sagal, in today for David Remnick.
And you see all the blackberries. Oh, they were not in bloom yesterday, but look at this cloud of white. It's all blackberries. There'll be jam and pie this summer.
I recently took a trip to Western New York, to its fields and its forests, to visit Robin Wall Kimmerer, an unlikely literary star, a botanist by training, a specialist in moss, an expert naturalist.
Catbird.
Is that what that is?
They keep it up all day long.
Kimmerer has had a long career in universities, but she felt constrained by the world of Western science. She's Native American, and the indigenous teachings she learned, the sense of connection she felt with the land, plants, and animals around her, had been dismissed by the scientific community. And well established in her career, Kimmerer set out to publish a collection of essays to bridge the divide. The result is Braiding Sweetgrass. It's published first by a small press. It's become a phenomenon since. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years and sold well over a million copies. Last year, Kimmerer received the MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called genius grant.
So yeah, let's walk up to the pond.
It's a decade since Braiding Sweetgrass was first published. And I went to talk with Robin Wall Kimmerer at her home outside Syracuse, New York.
What interests me is that, you know, when people write memoirs that are read and beloved, readers will talk to them about, like, oh, how's your mother and how's your sister? We act that way about your pond and your trees, right? Which is what you wanted.
It is. I love that. Because in that case, you know, it's an attachment to place, and you understand what it would be like to have that attachment, and to work for it.
So we're standing at the banks of this pond near her property,
It's ringed with willows and dogwoods. And it's loud. It's so full of birdsong and insects. It's noisier than my block in Brooklyn.
You see this bright, shiny yellow grass in here? That's sweet grass. Isn't it beautiful? Hold that for a little while, and as it starts to dry, it will give you the most wonderful fragrance.
When she bought the property, it was the pond was full of algae, choked with algae, and she worked very, very hard to dredge it out, to clean it, to make it a place where her daughters could swim, but also to return it to this loud, humming, squawking community around us.
So many birds. There they go. Look, there's that pair of little green herons, the parents taking off. You see the red-winged blackbirds over there, these dragonflies humming about. It really is, for me, a magical little place. There's so much life here. We just heard the yellow warbler there. Brown thrasher calling over there.
I love that you hear them, but they also must be registering you. They must be like, she's back. Robin is here. She's making her. She's brought some other humans with her this time.
It's true. It's true. I know they know me. My pandemic project, when we couldn't have friends over for dinner, I started having dinner parties at the pond for the winter birds. So I would go up and spread a table with all of these treats. And my goal was by the end of the winter to have the chickadees land on my hand and eat seeds from my hand. I thought it was going to take months. It took about 2 weeks. But yeah, I know they all know me.
You know, it's easier for me to describe what braiding sweetgrass does to a reader rather than describe the book itself. You know, it's a book that changes people, it moves them. You have a spiritual experience reading this book. If you haven't read it, imagine a series of linked essays that don't fit cleanly into any conceivable category. These are scientific essays. You know, why do asters and goldenrod bloom together in such intense display? Or why does maple sap flow so abundantly in the spring? But they're also a meditation on our relationship with the natural world, and they draw heavily on Native American teachings handed down from generation to generation. So Kimmerer's home is surrounded by rolling hay fields and farmland, but her house is ringed by giant maples.
Would you like a cold drink?
Yes, please.
We went inside and sat at her dining room table to talk. What were the earliest sort of seeds of this book for you? Before it was even a book, did it start as questions? Did it start as sentences? Where did you find it, or how did it find you?
For me, it really started with this notion that it feels to me that our relationship with land is broken. Mm-hmm. And so much of the environmental movement to me is grounded in fear, and we have a lot to be afraid about, and let's not, you know, ignore that. But what I really wanted to do was to try to find a way in which to help people really love the land again, because I think that's why we are where we are, that we haven't loved the land enough. And part of that for me is tied up with the notion that we look around us at all of this abundance and we call it natural resources. We think about it as ecosystem services or sometimes commodities, right? Whereas from my perspective, and very much grounded in a Potawatomi way of knowing, all of this is a gift. And what I was seeing is that most people don't understand the world as gift. And when you do, the response of gratitude and reciprocity flows from that. So I really set for myself this goal of seeing if we could help tell stories that would help people see the world as gift.
I want to imagine where you were when this mission, this great ambition sort of presented itself. Where were you living? Where were you, you know, what was happening in your life when you first started working on this book?
I was living here in the abundance of upstate New York. And at that time, my youngest daughter was still at home, about to leave for college. And So it was a transition time for me. It was also a time when I felt well established in my career as a scientist. I had fulfilled the sorts of things that tenure requires of you. I had done all those things which were expected of me. And I wanted also to do that thing which I wanted for myself, not what institutions wanted of me. And so that helped give me the impetus to write in what I think of as my true voice.
One of the mysteries about this book for me is it has to do with the voice and the sense. As I was reading it, sometimes I was like, who's speaking right now and who is being spoken to? There's a rotating point of view. Sometimes it feels to me that you're writing to your daughters, but then the point of view shifts and you actually have a chapter told from the point of view of your daughter. At some points, it feels like almost like you're trying to make a language for nature to speak to nature. Did you have a reader in mind as you were working on it and hearing your voice, your free voice for the first time? Did you imagine it finding readers in the world? Who was in your mind at that time?
I was quite explicitly writing for two audiences at the beginning. Little did I know there would be quite a different audience. But I was writing for my scientific colleagues in order to try to make the case for Indigenous science and traditional ways of knowing and reimagining what science looks like when it's imbued with values. So that was one audience. I also was writing always with my listening to Native people, that I wanted the stories that I told, the reflections that I shared, I wanted my Native community to say, yes, yes, this is true, this is our way, because I wanted to be very sensitive to the fact that this is my story, but it's not my knowledge. This is the knowledge of collective generations of people listening to the land. So those were the two audiences that I had in mind. But you're right that there's maybe an implicit audience. And for me, it is the land. You know, as a botanist, as a person who's just been madly in love with dirt and trees and birds forever, I wanted to be sure that I was representing them, that I was, it's not possible to fully tell their story, but I wanted them to be present and to create a sense of empathy and compassion and respect for the living world.
I mean, you describe yourself as being in love with dirt, but as I was reading this book, I started to keep a running list of words you were teaching me. And you're in love with dirt, but you're in love with language. And you taught me words that I'd never heard of. Wicker, the soft neighing sound of a horse. Ducks dabble, the way they skim off the top. I have this beautiful list of language you've given me. And I'm curious about the origins of your sensitivity to language. When did that happen?
What a good question. I certainly grew up in a family where there were fine storytellers. My dad was a wonderful storyteller and kind of the master of some of those old-time colorful expressions that I just loved. And so I'm sure that was an influence. But as a young person, I loved poetry. I still have the books that of poetry from when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. So it feels like an innate love of language, which is also part of being a scientist. You know, that precision in language, that little part of belief, it has a really particular name. so being steeped in the particularities of the living world that comes from science also appeals to my poetic self because of that discipline of finding just the right word.
The discipline and also the pleasure, right? When you describe a salamander's feeling soft like an overripe banana. That's pleasure for its own sake. You know, it's getting it right, but it is also just... So Kimmerer goes from being this academic scientist, and she was writing papers with titles like, and you know, I looked one up, Environmental Determinants of Spatial Pattern in the Vegetation of Abandoned Lead-Zinc Mines, to writing this book that's far more poetic, unclassifiable, searching. You know, and I, if you pick up this book and you go to the back of it and you see her bio, there's another really startling fact. She lists herself, before she lists herself as anything else, as a scientist or anything, she lists herself first as a mother. And that is unusual for any writer, let alone a scientist.
Yeah, I'm so glad you've highlighted this, because so often in the academy, we are asked to identify ourselves according to our institutions and our titles and our disciplines. And first and foremost, I know that I am a mother, because it's relationship, it's nurture, it's this sense of love, being loved by the world and having love for the world, that really propels me. And most of it, in most scientific disciplines, we're not even allowed to talk about that. We can't even say the words. And so for me, it's an act of resistance to first claim that I am a mother first. And for me, the boundaries between me being a mother and being nurtured by Shkok Mikwe, by Mother Earth, they feel like the same thing. It feels very whole to me. And so inevitably, I had to write about being a mother. And you know, another element of that is I'm constantly aware of the fact that what feels like second nature to me, of this intimacy with the land and plants, is not second nature to most of my readers. Nature is like a park or a wilderness area. And so I wanted to use mothering also as a vehicle for expressing the kind of relationship that one can have with the living land, being mothered by the land and mothering in return.
That's Robin Wall Kimmer, author of Braiding Sweetgrass. Our conversation continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Parul Sehgal. I'm a staff writer at the magazine. I've been speaking today with Robin Wall Kimmerer, author of Braiding Sweetgrass, a book about botany and much more that's been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. Braiding Sweetgrass shares Kimmerer's indigenous knowledge about the natural world, and one of the themes of her writing is her own family history. She's an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation, and her family's story contains the history of American Indian policy in the U.S. Her ancestors were forcibly removed 3 times in a single generation, pushed out of their homelands around Lake Michigan, and left essentially to starve in Oklahoma. It's one reason why it feels so powerful for Kimmerer to come back, reclaim these teachings in Braiding Sweetgrass. They were so nearly lost.
Yeah. They say that we are inevitably living our ancestors' stories, and joyfully I am. I think about, in particular, my grandfather, who at only 9 years old, who was taken from his family on our reserve in Oklahoma and sent to the Carlisle Indian School, whose motto, you may know, was to kill the Indian to save the man. It was the most violent sort of colonial assimilative enterprise. And I always knew those stories growing up. I also knew of my grandfather's resilience and resistance to that painful, painful chapter. But when I was a little kid, I longed for culture. And I would ask my dad, you know, what's the word for this? Or what's the ceremony for that? And he always had to say, I don't know. That was taken from us at Carlisle. I'm so grateful to him that he didn't just say, I don't know. He said, this was taken from us. So that wound was always present for me. But as a young kid, I remember saying, if there could be schools that are designed to take that away, doesn't that mean there could be schools that are designed to give it back, to bring it back? And so that story has really laid a path for me. So every word of our language that I learn feels like a little piece of healing. And so, the wounds of colonialism, attempted erasure, attempted genocide are at the heart of the book. This is a book about resilience and remembering and recovery as well. It's, you know, I think really early on in the formation of Breeding Sweetgrass, I wrote with what seemed hubris at the moment to say, I want this book to be medicine. And it turns out I think it has been.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you first realized that the book was starting to take off? Did you hear from readers? How did you come to know?
It began for me with letters, with real letters. And I remember the first one. I had a wonderful airmail letter from someone in France. And I thought, what? Someone in France is reading Braiding Sweetgrass, and their response of how it helped them love land more. I thought, well, that's just wonderful. I have a reader. And it meant so much to me. It meant so, I still have that letter. And boxes of others, of beautiful handwritten correspondence and emails. And it was at first overwhelming to me. I had never any expectation that this book would find a wide audience. And so I feel deeply responsible to readers, because they share often really intimate stories of awakening, of healing, of their own, what I would call longing for relationship with place. And so that it fills my heart, but it also sometimes makes my heart heavy, because it's a lot to carry. But I also am buoyed up by the fact that really often those letters come with a celebration of, and guess what I did? I started a community garden. I began a forest preschool. The letter from someone who said, I work on Wall Street and I can no longer do so. And I am now moving to the Northeast and to moving north and starting an organic farm. Hundreds of letters of people who are changing their lives because they're remembering something. They're remembering how they want to live.
You know, there's a wonderful moment in your first book, Gathering Moss, where you say that, when you look at moss shouldn't have made it. Moss is small. Moss can't grab onto almost anything, can it, really? You know, moss has to live in like the little cracks in the fissures, but, you know, it teaches us poignant things right now, you write. And you say that it's about leaving more than you take, and working together and staying small. And I think you wrote that about 10 years before Braiding Sweetgrass.
I did.
Right? And I think about Braiding Sweetgrass with its own questions. As you say, you know, you were writing it when your own girls were leaving home, right? It's a book about the culmination of certain kinds of mothering. And I'm wondering here now, what sorts of questions are preoccupying you? Are you looking at the moss again? What are you looking at?
First, I want to say that both gathering moss and breeding sweetgrass are works of love for mosses, for the world, and in the case of my children leaving, is also like an exercise of what am I going to do with all of this love, right? When I don't have to make peanut butter sandwiches, what am I going to do with all that love? Yeah, you make me cry too. And I'm still in that place, but in a place which now, how to say, you know, the world that I'm so in love with is on the precipice. And so that's what consumes me. How can stories, how can Indigenous knowledge be the medicine that can bring us back from the brink? I don't know that it can be, but I'm certainly going to try, because that's the gift that's been given to me. Yeah. To me, when I think about what will pull us back from the brink is a change in worldview, away from this human exceptionalism and into kinship with the living world. If we really felt and understood and embodied kinship with the living world, we wouldn't cause our family to go extinct, right? We wouldn't. And so what I'm trying to do now with another writing project is to try to somehow really connect with readers to the personhood of nature, to the beingness of other species, and to really try to write in such a way that creates a wave of ecological compassion. So that's where my head and heart are. Mm-hmm.
Does the response to your book and the way it has been embraced and recommended, I mean, this was a book that is a success because people were placing it in other people's hands, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Does that make you feel optimistic?
It does. It does. The very fact that people are reading a book about plants, that they're reading a book about plants from an Indigenous perspective, and that people are answering this call of reciprocity. You know, breeding sweetgrass is an invitation, isn't it? It's an invitation into reciprocity to say, what is your gift and how could you give it to the world? And what I'm hearing as I travel and in correspondence, I'm hearing this huge yes. How I'm experiencing this is a word that you used at the outset, and that is of a kind of remembering. I think when there are audiences of people in tears, I think, what is this about? This is about remembering what it would be like to be nurtured by the earth. And it's like people are deeply lonely for that. And so that gives me a lot of hope that there isn't this emotional response. But, you know, it makes me think about a wonderful prompt that some fellow writers and I used in a conference once. We said, what do you love too much to lose? We said to the audience, and we said to them, and what are you going to do about it? Their list of what do I love too much to lose was endless. And the list of what am I going to do about it was wholly inadequate to the moment.
That's Robin Wall Kimmerer, author of Breeding Sweetgrass, which was released 10 years ago this year. We spoke near her home in upstate New York. I'm Farrell Sagal. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Bit of climate news before we go. This month, a Montana judge delivered a historic ruling in environmental law.
The case was Held versus Montana. 16 youth plaintiffs sued the state for failing to protect their right to a clean environment, which is written into the Montana state constitution. The judge ruled in their favor. She permanently enjoined two state laws having to do with permits for mining and energy projects. One of the expert witnesses for the plaintiffs was Lisa Van Susteren, a psychologist who specializes in what's become known as climate anxiety. Earlier this summer, she spoke with David Remnick on our program and talked about the psychological harm that climate change is causing young people.
When it has come to understanding that kids are hearing, scientists tell us that we are looking at the extinction of species and maybe even of our own. And unless they're living in a cave, it's going to bother them. So, yeah, we have a very serious mental health crisis in kids. And yes, it is disproportionately on them because they will disproportionately feel the cumulative effect of climate instability.
Is it possible to quantify the crisis, especially when it comes to climate?
The answer, short answer, is no. Anxiety exists in the brain. And think of it as a big, dark, black pool. In that big pool, it is impossible to quantify today. I'm anxious about climate this much, about not looking good that much, and about not getting into the right school a different amount. But here's what I can tell you. I participated in a survey that we launched in 2021 and had the results in the fall. And in it, we surveyed 10,000 kids from 10 countries all over the world. And here's what we found. 3/4 of the kids are worried about the future because of climate. Almost half of them say it affects their daily lives. More than half say they feel a sense of doom about the future. And here's what's interesting to somebody like me, because I'm really focusing on policy. 2/3 of those kids lay the blame firmly at the feet of government.
I grew up with a nuclear threat. I even was probably the last generation of kids who scurried into a hallway or under desks.
Under desks. What was that going to do for us?
Well, the desk was going to prevent you from nuclear annihilation, apparently. And so obviously this fed into our anxiety, and, but it was kind of inchoate and rarely spoken of. How is this different?
Well, think about it. We, at the time, thought the Soviets or the Russians, it wasn't communists, in my mind, were going to do something really bad. I didn't exactly know, you probably didn't either, what nuclear war was. But that is very different from what the kids know today. If you're a kid today, you can see a fire, a flood, a storm. You can hear about homes and places that have been leveled. Mm-hmm. This is very, it's something that is extremely visual. They can understand at a very grassroots level what this means. Nuclear war and a mushroom cloud, what is that?
You see patients, right?
Sure, I do, Sue. Yeah.
And what do they tell you? What are you hearing directly from kids that you talk to?
So I have spoken with young people extensively, but not as patients. And we need to recognize that we must not pathologize climate distress. Mm-hmm. But kids are talking about their anger. They're talking about their fear. They're talking about their despair. They're talking about feelings of abandonment. They are talking about betrayal. And they don't understand why the adults in the room are not taking more action. So let me just say one thing that is pretty characteristic that I have found, and in many of the most sensitive kids, is what I've dubbed pre-traumatic stress, which is anticipation of future harms and has all the hallmarks of post-traumatic stress, but it's in conjuring what will happen in the future.
You said that we shouldn't pathologize climate distress. What do you mean by that?
Not to think of it as a mental illness. Mm-hmm. If it was to be a mental illness to if you saw somebody on the tracks and the train was coming, to be alarmed and scream at the person to get off the tracks, well, that's the equivalent.
What you're saying is a logical response to an imminent threat.
It's more than logical. It's a survival strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I started a group called the Climate Aware Therapists because I got so many calls from people who were non-functional. And that's when you can begin to talk about it as an entity that should be recognized within my professional groups as becoming a mental, maybe illness is too strong a term, but a condition.
How prevalent is that?
Mm-hmm. Climate distress itself, I believe we're all anxious now, whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not, whether we admit it or not. But when it reaches the level of a person who is no longer functional, I can't tell you the numbers, but I certainly have heard them anecdotally.
That's Lisa von Sustren, who is an expert witness in Held versus Montana. The judge just ruled that two of the state's energy policies were unconstitutional and permanently enjoined them. I'm Barl Sagel. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I really enjoyed being with you on the show this week. David Remnick will be back next week. Thank you for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett.
And special assistance in the editing of this week's program from Karen Frillman.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.